Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I discussed banks as traders. Commercial banks have traditionally invested conservatively in government securities, but that is not true of investment banks. The Glass-Steagall Act, requiring commercial banking and investment banking to be conducted in separate institutions, was repealed in 1999 following assurances that these banking functions would be separated by Chinese walls within the organizations. First critical point here is how much the congressional thinking is just to allow the banks to self-regulate. The effect of this has been devastating on the American economy because the banks get wealthier as the masses lose extraordinarily in the wake of this self-regulation. Well, what are Chinese walls? Chinese walls are defined as information barriers implemented in firms to separate and isolate persons within a firm who make investment decisions from persons within a firm who are privy to undisclosed material information which may influence those decisions to safeguard inside information and ensure there is no improper trading. In other words, with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and the Chinese walls coming into being, banks are supposed to just be very honest in their separation from the investment department to the commercial department. However, the reality is that Chinese walls are paper thin, and there are significant differences between commercial and investment banks that make them uneasy partners. Commercial banks have traditionally taken in deposits, issued commercial loans, and otherwise served their customers. Investment banks are not allowed to take in deposits or make commercial loans. They raise money for their clients by overseeing stock issuance and sales. Their more important business today, however, is something called proprietary trading. Proprietary trading is a term used in investment banking to describe when a bank trades stocks, bonds, options, commodities, or other items with its own money as opposed to its customers' money so as to make a profit for itself. Although investment banks are usually defined as businesses which assist other businesses in raising money in the capital markets by selling stocks or bonds, in fact, most of the largest investment banks make the majority of their profit from trading activities. It's obvious that the potential for conflicts of interest are great here, and this was evident in 2007 when investment bank Goldman Sachs made a killing betting its own money against the subprime mortgage market at the same time that it was selling structured investment vehicles laced with subprime debt to its clients. This conflicts of interest problem was discussed in a June 2006 article by Emily Thornton in Business Week Online titled "Inside Wall Street's Culture of Risk: Investment Banks Are Placing Bigger Bets Than Ever and Beating the Odds, at least for now." Long title. After discussing the new boom in bank trading, Thornton observed that investment bank wizards have so consistently beaten the odds that, quote, "suspicions are rising that bank traders are acting on non-public information gleaned from their clients," end of the quote. Trading for the bank's own accounts has been criticized not only for suspected ethical violations, but because it exposes the banks to enormous risks. Thornton continued, quote, "This trading boom, fueled by cheap money, is fundamentally different from the ones of the past. When traders last ruled Wall Street during the mid-90s, few banks put much of their own balance sheets at risk. Most acted mainly as brokers, arranging trades between clients. Now, virtually all banks are making huge bets with their own assets on many more fronts and using vast sums of borrowed money to jack up the risk even more." End quote. Where do these vast sums of borrowed money come from? Although investment banks are not allowed to take in deposits or make loans of imaginary money based on the fractional reserve system that we've talked about so much, commercial banks can do this. With the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, the lines between these two forms of banking have become very blurred, and it is not hard to envision bank traders having ready access to some very favorable loans based on, obviously, inside information. Thornton continues, quote, "Many investment banks now do more trading than all the biggest hedge funds, those lightly regulated investment pools that almost brought down the financial system in 1998, when one of them, Long-Term Capital Management, blew up. What's more, banks are jumping into the realm of private equity, spending billions to buy struggling businesses as far afield as China that they hope to turn around and sell at a profit." If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Equity is ownership interest in a corporation, and the equity market is the stock market. These banks are not just investing in short-term treasury bills on which they collect a modest interest. as commercial banks have traditionally done. They are buying whole businesses with borrowed money, and they are doing it not to develop the productive potential of the business, but just to reap a quick profit on resale. Leading the attack in this lucrative new field, says Thornton, is the very successful investment bank Goldman Sachs, headed by Henry Paulson Jr. until he left the firm to become U.S. Treasury Secretary in June 2006. Although Paulson was no longer at the helm, says Thornton, Goldman is showing no sign of easing up, and neither are its cronies. Quote, with $25 billion of capital under management, Goldman's private equity arm itself is one of the largest buyout firms in the world. All of them are ramping up teams of so-called proprietary traders who play with the bank's own money. Banks are paying up, offering some traders $10 million to $20 million a year, end quote. The practice of buying whole corporations in order to bleed them of their profits has been given the less charitable name of vulture capitalism. Why the term fits was underscored in a January 2006 article by Sean Corrigan called Speculation in the Late Empire. He writes, quote, when the buyout merchants and private equity partnerships can borrow what are effectively limitless sums of cheap, tax-advantaged debt with which to buy out corporate shareholders, not all of them willing sellers, remember, when they can then proceed to ruin the target business's balance sheet in a flash by ordering payment of special dividends and by weighing it down with junk debt in order to return their funds at the earliest juncture, when their pecuniary motives are mollified by so little pretense of undertaking any genuine entrepreneurial restructuring with which to enhance the economic efficiency, when they can rake in an even greater haul of loot by selling the firm smartly back to the next debt-swollen suckers in line, probably into the little man's sagging pension funds via the inevitable well-hyped IPO, initial public offering, when they can scatter fees and commissions and often political contributions liberally along the way, then we're clearly well past the point of reason or endorsement, end quote. Noting the outrageously skewed incomes made by bank traders at the top of the field, including Henry Paulson, who made over $30 million at Goldman Sachs the previous year, Corrigan goes on and asks rhetorically, quote, why train to be a farmer or a pharmacologist when you can join Merrill Lynch and become a millionaire in your mid-20s using someone else's capital and benefiting from being an insider in the great Ponzi scheme in which we live? End quote. All major markets are now thought to be subject to the behind-the-scenes maneuverings of big financial players, and these manipulations are being done largely with what Corrigan calls phantom money. A June 2006 article in Barron's noted that the bond market today is dominated by banks and government entities, and that they are not buying the bonds for their interest income. Rather, the reality is that they are only interested in currency manipulation and market contrivement. I understand that this is complicated in a number of ways, but we're going to look at what is really going on behind the scenes by better understanding the tools used by big money to manipulate markets. We're going to take a look at the investment vehicle known as the short sale, which underlies many of those more arcane tools known as derivatives. A massive wave of short selling was blamed for turning the Roaring Twenties into the Great Depression. The same sort of manipulations are going on today, but under different names. We're going to see how bear raids and short sales are devouring capital markets. The crash that initiated the Great Depression wasn't a one-time occurrence. It continued for nearly 4 years after 1929, stoked by speculators who made huge profits not only on the market's meteoric rise, but as it was plummeting. Unstrained financial exploitations have been one of the great causes of our present tragic condition, according to Roosevelt in 1933. A four-year industry-wide bear raid reduced the Dow Jones Industrial Average, a leading stock index, to only 10% of its former value. A bear raid is the practice of targeting stock for takedown, either for quick profits or for corporate takeover. It's an important concept. I'll say it again. A bear raid is the practice of targeting stock for takedown, either for quick profits or for corporate takeover. Whenever the market decline slowed after the 1929 crash, speculators would step in to sell millions of dollars worth of stock they did not own, but had ostensibly borrowed just for purposes of sale, using the device known as the short sale. When done on a large enough scale, short selling can actually force prices down, allowing assets to be picked up very cheaply. Here's how it works. Stock prices are set on the trading floor by traders, those people you see wildly yelling, waving, and signaling to each other on TV, whose job is to match buyers with sellers. Short sellers willing to sell at any price are matched with the low ball buy orders. Since stock prices are set according to supply and demand, when sell orders overwhelm buy orders, the price drops. There's lots and lots of sell orders, and there's not many buy orders, so of course the price is going to drop to sell the stock. The short sellers then buy the stocks back at the lower price and pocket the difference. Today, speculators have to drop the price only enough to trigger the automatic stop-loss orders and margin calls of the big mutual funds and hedge funds. Now, what are these? A stop-loss order is an order to sell when the price reaches a certain threshold. A margin call is a demand by a broker to a customer trading on margin, trading on credit or with borrowed funds, to add funds or securities to his margin account to bring it up to the percentage of the stock price required as a down payment by federal regulations. Most traders sell rather than pay the additional money. A mutual fund is a company that brings together money from many people and invests it. Hedge funds are investment companies that use high-risk techniques such as borrowing money and selling short in an effort to make extraordinary capital gains for their investors. So let's repeat the point. Speculators have to drop the price only enough to trigger the automatic stop-loss orders and margin calls of the big mutual funds and hedge funds. A cascade of sell orders follows, and the price plummets. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The short sale is explained by market analyst Richard Geist using a simple analogy. Quote, pretend that you borrowed your neighbor's lawnmower, which your neighbor generously says you may keep for a couple of weeks while he's on vacation. You're thinking of buying a lawnmower anyway, so you've been researching the latest sales and have seen your neighbor's lawnmower on sale for $300, marked down from $500. While you're mowing your lawn, a passerby stops and offers to buy the lawnmower you're using for $450. You sell him the lawnmower, then go out and buy the same one on sale for $300 and return it to your neighbor when he returns. Only, now you've made $150 on the deal. Geist goes on and applies this analogy to a hypothetical stock trade. You believe Amazon is overvalued and its price is going to fall. So, as a short seller, you borrow Amazon stock, which, like the lawnmower, you don't own, from a broker and sell it into the market. You borrow and sell 100 shares of Amazon at $50 per share, yielding a gain, exclusive of commissions, of $5,000. Your research proves correct, and a few weeks later, Amazon is selling for $35 per share. You then buy 100 shares of Amazon for $3,500 and return the 100 shares to the broker. You then have closed your position, and in the meantime, you've made $1,500. It sounds harmless enough when you are borrowing your neighbor's lawnmower with his permission. But when short sellers sell stock they don't own, they don't actually get the permission of the real owners. And selling your neighbor's lawnmower won't affect lawnmower prices at Sears. In the stock market, by contrast, prices fluctuate from moment to moment according to the number of shares for sale. When millions of shares are sold without ever leaving the possession of their real owners, these virtual sales can force down the price even when there has been no change in the underlying asset to justify the drop. Indeed, this can and often does happen when the news about the stock is good, because speculators want to take down the price so they can buy in cheaply. The price is not responding to free market forces. It is responding to speculators with the collusive battering power to overwhelm the market with sell orders, orders that are actually phony because the sellers don't own the stock. Like fractional reserve lending, in which the name reserves are lent many times over, short selling has been called a fraud, one that damages the real shareholders and the company. Analyst David Knight explains it like this, quote, "Short selling is a form of counterfeiting. When a company is founded, a certain number of shares are created. The entire value of that company is represented by that fixed number of shares. When an investor buys some of those shares and leaves them registered in his broker's street name, his broker makes those same shares available for someone else to sell short. Once sold short, there are two investors owning the same shares of stock. The price of stock shares are set by market forces, that is, supply and demand. When there is a fixed supply of something, the price adjusts until demand is met. But when supply is not fixed, as when something is counterfeited, supply will exceed demand and the price will fall. Price will continue to fall as long as supply continues to expand beyond demand. Furthermore, price decline is not a linear function of supply expansion. At some point, if supply continues to expand beyond a demand, the bottom will fall out of the market and prices will plunge." End of quote. Just to be clear, counterfeit means to make a copy of, usually with the intent to defraud, to carry on a deception. And this short selling is a form of counterfeiting. The lending of shares by a broker who holds them in trust for his customers is comparable to the goldsmith's lending of gold held in trust for his depositors that we have discussed at length in the past. The broker's customers may have agreed to lend out their shares in the fine print of their brokerage contracts, but they are probably not aware of it. They could avoid having their shares lent out by taking physical possession of the stock, but if they leave the stock with the broker, as nearly everyone does, it is in street name and can be lent out and sold without the real owner's knowledge, although they still believe in the company and have no intention of flooding the market with their shares. An April 2006 article in Bloomberg Markets highlighted another serious problem with short selling. The short seller is actually allowed to vote the shares at shareholder meetings. To avoid having to reveal what is going on, stockbrokers send proxies to the real owners as well, but that means there are duplicate proxies floating around. Just as bankers get away with lending the same money over and over because they know most people won't come to collect the cash, brokers know that many shareholders won't go to the trouble of voting their shares. And when too many proxies do come in for a particular vote, the totals are just reduced proportionally to fit. But that means the real votes of real stock owners may be thrown out. Hedge funds are suspected of engaging in short selling just to vote on particular issues in which they are interested, such as hostile corporate takeovers. Since many shareholders don't send in their proxies, interested short sellers can swing the vote in a direction that is not in the best interest of those with a real stake in the corporation. Some of the damage caused by short selling was blunted by the Securities Act of 1933, which imposed an uptick rule and forbade naked short selling. The uptick rule required a stock's price to be higher than its previous sale price before a short sale could be made, preventing a cascade of short sales when stocks are going down. But hedge funds managed to avoid the rule by trading offshore where they were unregulated. And in July 2007, the uptick rule was repealed. Naked short selling is the practice of selling stocks short without either owning or borrowing them. Like many of the regulations put in place during Roosevelt's New Deal, that rule too has been seriously eroded. Now let's start looking at the nefarious and ubiquitous naked short sale. According to a November 2005 article in Time magazine, quote, "Naked short selling is illegal, barring certain exceptions for brokers trying to maintain an orderly market. In naked short selling, you execute the sale without borrowing the stock." The SEC noted in a report last year the pervasiveness of the practice. When not caught, this kind of selling has no limits and allows the seller to drive down a stock. End of quote. A May 2004 Dow Jones report confirmed that naked short selling is a manipulative practice that can drive a company's stock price sharply lower. End quote. The exception that has turned the rule into a sham is a July 2005 SEC ruling allowing the practice by market makers. A market maker is a bank or brokerage that stands ready to buy and sell a particular stock on a continuous basis at a publicly quoted price. The catch is that market makers are the brokers who actually do most of the buying and selling of stock today. 95% of short sales are now done by broker-dealers and market makers. Market making is one of the lucrative pursuits of those 10 giant U.S. banks called money center banks, which currently hold almost half the country's total banking assets, which we will discuss later. And in the next show, I will look more deeply into examples of naked short selling and how this influences the markets. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.